Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy. Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Dr. Mary Dozier, an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Mississippi State University. She's carried out research into numerous aspects of hoarding disorder. She is a tea enthusiast, which means we are bound to get along, especially Earl Grey, I agree. And she is here to talk about animal hoarding. Mary, how are you?
I am doing wonderful. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Thank you so much. So you have looked into hoarding in a range of research studies. What led you to the animal hoarding research you did in particular?
Animal hoarding, I feel like, is something that is so misunderstood. So hoarding disorder in general, I feel like there's so much stigma around it, as we were talking about a little bit before we started recording. And I feel like with animal hoarding, there's kind of this extra layer, because a lot of things get just labeled as animal hoarding that are actually a lot of different things. So there are, you know, quote unquote, bad actors out there who are doing, you know, breeding animals for profit and bad reasons. And that sort of seedy nature of capitalism gets put in with people who legitimately have psychological problems and are not intending to have harm for the animals, that it's often the opposite. And I just find that part so fascinating, of a little bit of how can we kind of separate out those two things so that we can get help to the people who truly need help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's important to be clear, as you were just saying, exactly what we're talking about. So how is animal hoarding defined?
So animal hoarding is generally defined as having more animals than one can care for. So there's not a good sort of psychological definition of it, that it's a bit of a footnote in our hoarding disorder chapter, say, of the DSM, which is what Americans tend to use for diagnosing. And so I think the rest of the world uses the ICD.
We do.
Yes. But so how I kind of conceptualize animal hoarding as a psychological disorder is people who have more animals than they can care for and don't have insight into that fact. So that there has to be this distress and dysfunction for the person as well. But generally, when we talk about what makes something a disorder versus, say, normal anxiety, right? That there's having anxiety is generally a healthy thing, but it gets to this point where it becomes distressing and dysfunctional for the person. And that's where we give someone an anxiety disorder. And animal hoarding is the same way, right? That there could be somebody who has 20 animals, but it's not distressing or dysfunctional for them or the animals. That they, you know, I live here in Mississippi where people have lots and lots of animals because they have lots of space. But I think when it gets to the point that it's no longer functional for the person or the animals, that that's where we really start to have those conversations of, is there a psychological problem happening here?
And is it recognized in the DSM, the ICD, or is it just kind of grouped with hoarding disorder as an added extra?
Yeah, so my understanding is right now it is still grouped with hoarding disorder. There have been several publications of folks trying to advocate for it as a separate disorder. And I think part of the problem is that we don't have a lot of information about it, that it's a hard research to do, in part because folks who have this problem tend to have very low insight into the problem itself. So it can be hard to get people to participate in research studies, which I very much understand, right? That there's this risk of having your animals taken away. And if your animals, you care for them like they're your children, that why would you take that risk to be part of research?
Does hoarding animals always coexist with hoarding stuff, or are there people who hoard animals and not stuff?
That's a great question. So we tend to see that it can overlap, but it doesn't always overlap. So, and I think a lot of that has to do with how the animal hoarding came about, right? So for some folks, it can be something that people almost age into, that when they were younger, they were able to take care of the animals. But then as they got older, animals can create new animals, say, if not kept apart. And so the number of animals that one has can increase. And as you're getting older and having more physical problems, it can be harder to take care of them. And another thing that happens as we age is our decision-making ability goes down. And so sometimes folks have a harder time seeing the problem. And even if the problem is just their own ability to take care of the animals, that they might not recognize the difference of their functioning at 60 versus 40.
Yeah. And I would imagine if you have an out of control number of animals, you might end up hoarding stuff through just not managing your environment rather than pure hoarding stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And what do we know about the scale of it? I have Google Alerts set up where you get an email every time certain words are mentioned, and I have them set up for hoarding and hoarding disorder. And if they are anything to go by, animal hoarding is rife. I'm getting daily emails about terrible, situations where animals are rescued from really distressing situations. But then that could equally reflect what's newsworthy rather than that this is a vast problem. Do we have any idea of what kind of proportion of people or how many people it affects?
Near as we can tell, it's probably about the same level as hoarding disorder, about 2% of the population. So some of the research we were doing in Mississippi was trying to get a sense of kind of patterns of animal ownership and health outcomes. And we did find that people with 8 or more animals that in the household, that those animals tended to have worse health outcomes. And it wasn't for everyone, right? There's the folks that have 8 horses and no problems, or 8 mice or whatever. But also with that, we found that around the same rates that we would have expected for hoarding, it kind of that higher level. I think that part, again, the problem is how we define it, right? So of getting that sense of who are we saying has animal hoarding? And I think for what you were kind of saying about the news articles, of that they highlight people with the most, right? And we see that the same with object hoarding, but you'll see on the news of somebody died in their house and nobody found them. And then people try to say that that's what all hoarding looks like. And we know that that's not true, right? That animal hoarding, much like object hoarding, is going to be something that happens on a spectrum, right? Where there is just normal, healthy attachment with items and healthy attachment with animals. And there are people that are at that very far extreme where we're having 40 dogs rescued from a house, say. But there will also be people who maybe just have 4 dogs. And at that point, it's too much for them to be able to handle. And so I think that's where some of the definitional part can get really tricky.
Yeah, because as you said earlier, if you live on a giant farm, you can have a lot of animals that are happy and healthy and have space. If you live in a tiny flat in the middle of a city, 4 dogs is a lot.
I had a rabbit who passed away last fall. And even just think that I had one rabbit in my household, but even as she got older, you know, her needs increased, right? But just taking care of that one rabbit became more difficult. It also combined with is my work increased, right? That so thinking about like, there's a lot of variables that go into, are you able to provide your animal with proper care?
I read some of the studies you worked on, and there were lots of different numbers, and I appreciate that different studies look at things in different ways. You were referencing other studies, and it was so one said there was an average of 94 animals in each household, but another said 30 to 40. And I appreciate it's, you know, the way the study's done and who they found, and but also what kind of animals. What I read was that it's most commonly cats, dogs, and rabbits, but then also reptiles, birds, guinea pigs, raccoons, which does not make sense to British ears, ferrets, and livestock. So it can really be varied.
And I think that in many ways parallels what we see with object hoarding, right? That, you know, because that's a question I get so often with hoarding disorder, like, well, what kinds of things do people keep? And I say, well, they keep everything, right? But in that it's different for every person, yes. Right? That for one person, you know, it might be so important to keep all old cards. And for another person, they're like, I have no problem with that, but I, you know, I can't get rid of any old electronics, right? And I think for animals, it's probably a similar thing of, what kind of animal do you feel that attachment to? Do you feel this need to rescue? But it's just going to differ by person.
And also, as somebody who hoards stuff and not animals, at least my stuff can't reproduce spontaneously. If I have too many books, they're not going to multiply into more books. If I have too many books, I say, as if that's a question.
I do love that idea as an avid reader myself, that if you just had two books, suddenly they would make you a third book to read.
That's a children's book up there, isn't it? I think you need to write that book.
But I think it's such an important thing to think about, that the amount of, that you ultimately do have control over the things that come into your home. I mean, at a certain point, other people give us things, and I wish I could stop the junk mail from coming to my home, that there are these things that aren't quite in our control. But by and large, once things are in our home, they're not making more things. And I think that's something that's often lost when we think about animal hoarding, of that part of it is that, you know, two dogs can suddenly lead to 12 dogs quite quickly.
Yeah, and you might have thought really carefully about whether you can manage two dogs and been really responsible about that. And then suddenly it feels out of control. And then I guess the more out of control it feels, if the dogs are maybe a bit unwell or a bit neglected, you might then avoid taking them to the vet, and then things go further wrong. So you avoid, I can really imagine it can spiral like that.
And I know so often with people with object hoarding that I've worked with, it's often very important for them that the things that they're discarding go to a certain place, that they want to feel like, you know, if I'm getting rid of this book, well, this book has been important to me. I want to make sure that it goes to a place where I feel like it will be appreciated. And I imagine that for animals, that's even more so, right? That you're, you know, it's easy to find a home for a book, so to speak, right? That it's like many people have a bookshelf they can put it on. But to be like, will this person be able to adequately care for this dog? Is kind of even a next level kind of concern.
Yeah, definitely. And do we know much about who this affects? Is it similar demographics to people who hoard objects?
My understanding is it is going to be similar in terms of it's going to be people across the lifespan. And much like we see with object hoarding, it's going to get reinforced over time, right? That every time you're like, I'm just going to keep this cat. It's easier to say, well, that cat had kittens and I love that cat, so I'm going to love these kittens and I'm going to hold on to them. And so that kind of decision-making at that point makes that easier down the road. And so I think probably makes it harder as you get older. So I would expect to see similar increases in kind of the severity of it with age.
I know a previous interviewee said to me, after we've recorded, she said, we were talking about hoarding disorder in general and who it affects. And she said, the studies make it look, as she said, something like, with all due respect, but like it's people like you, like it's white women in their 40s. But actually what that is that's the people who might come forward. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard. We know there are younger people and older people and men, but they are not the people who will come forward and seek help or be part of studies. And so it's really hard to know what's going on. And I would imagine that's compounded even more with animal hoarding.
Definitely. And all of the stigma that goes around that. And I loved what you said that so often people almost want mental health to be like a disease where like you catch it. And so it's like, oh, we're going to like see it, trace it through people. It's like, it's something that affects everyone. Right? The mental health is a problem for everyone. And it's this, you know, hoarding is a part of that, of something that people feel across a continuum. So I guess kind of back to that idea of people really want it to be this extreme thing. And I try to, as much as I can, emphasize for folks of like, everybody struggles with this in different ways, right? That we all have items that we don't use, but we keep for sentimental reasons. Right, that I have a book I'm never going to read again, but my grandpa gave it to me and he's passed away. And so keeping that helps me feel that connection. And so with animals, it's the same, right? Many people have animals they're not providing proper care for, even if it's just one cat. And so thinking about, well, why would you keep that one cat if you're struggling with care, right? And what does that look like when you have 15 cats?
And it's easy to look at the headlines I get in my Google alerts that are of the worst cases, which are, you know, genuinely devastating for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to look at those people and immediately demonize them. And yet few people are doing the early work that would prevent things from getting to that point. And that's not to not hold those people accountable, but it's hard to interrupt a cycle if there's no provision.
And that's exactly why on this most recent research study I did, we were working with people at the veterinary school here at Mississippi, that this idea of that those are the folks who do see the animals, right? And so to kind of wanted to do some of that preliminary work to then talk about, okay, how do we help veterinarians or other folks who might be able to catch these issues early on to have those hard conversations, right? That in hospital settings, oftentimes, you know, psychologists are part of a treatment team. A medical doctor can say, oh, let me bring in my colleague to have this conversation, but we don't necessarily do that in veterinary settings, right? That we often are so focused on the animal that it's hard to see the person that's there with the animal and to think, what are the factors going on in their life that's affecting the animal care?
Because especially if you've dedicated your life to animal care and you see a distressed animal in front of you, I appreciate that it's difficult to not be angry at the person who maybe hasn't given it enough water or hasn't dealt with the fleas, but not addressing it at that stage does nobody any favors.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Let's try something new. I've had an idea for a new segment for the podcast, and it involves you introducing listener voicemails. Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail and leave me a brief recording to play on future podcast episodes. Let's have a go and see how it works. Let me know what you're thinking at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail. So there are people, as we've talked a little bit about, who hoard animals believing they're doing a good thing. They think they have a rescue. Is that a common belief? And is it a genuine belief? Do they genuinely believe they're helping the animals, or is it a kind of excuse after the fact?
I think that's a really tough question. And my understanding is that yes, that they very much do in their mind feel like they're saving the animal, right? And many times they are the person who truly did save that animal that they found on a highway, right? That they took an animal from a place that was objectively unsafe for the animal and brought them into their home. And I think where the disconnect happens is the person's insight into whether or not their home is the right home for that animal, of trying to understand of that. I do think that for so often these people that have animal hoarding as a psychological disorder truly do believe that they're helping the animals, that they have a genuine love for these animals. And they're just not able to kind of see what the state is. And I think part of that might be perhaps like trouble with knowing what the alternatives are, maybe trusting that animal rescue services would actually help the animals. I don't know about in the UK, but I know in the United States, we have a lot of trouble with shelters getting over full. So that there's a big issue of animals having to be put down just because they can't find a home. So I think that a lot of kind of those facts can get blown up in somebody's mind to the point that they feel like they're the only person who can rescue those animals.
And we can't ignore the reality that even if somebody really, really believes they're doing a good thing and they are looking after an animal that nobody else would look after, it's really not benign. It has a really difficult effect on the animals. There are dead animals in a lot of homes. Animals aren't very well cared for. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, that it's a difficult situation, right? And I think that's where my hope is that I know that a lot of cities in the US and Canada have started having hoarding task forces for connecting, like, say, fire department and police with mental health professionals, so that when they're having those difficult conversations with people with hoarding disorder about their homes maybe being fire hazards, that they can do it in a place that's respectful for the person. And I think my hope is that we can do that with animals as well. But instead of having animal protective services kind of come in and take away all the animals all at once, that it, you know, could there be a way that we get mental health professionals as part of that conversation to talk about, okay, do we need to take away all of the animals, or is it possible that, you know, can we take away the animals that aren't being treated well? Could this person be able to manage one cat? Right? What is the issue that's leading to the maltreatment of the animals, and try to work with the person to figure out, okay, where's that disconnect? What are the kind of psychosocial problems in their life that are preventing that proper animal care? Because I think that one of the things that we often see with people with these animal hoarding tendencies is that because they do want to rescue these animals and have that sense that they're the person that needs to do it, when their animals are taken away, that they might still just seek out other animals. But there's been, you were talking about news cases, that there's always cases of people being reported that, you know, move to different counties or states and then reacquired a bunch of animals. So I think the more we can integrate, like, treating the person for the problem instead of just being like, we'll take away the animals and that'll fix the problem. It's the person is still having their own dysfunction of going on of that's causing it. And I think about it a lot akin to when we treat people with anorexia, that one of the first things they do is they, you know, put people up to a stabilized weight, that they make people eat food so that their weight goes to a healthy place. But if you don't treat that underlying psychological problem, as soon as they leave the treatment facility, they're going to go back to not eating, right? Their weight's going to go back down.
Is there a role for, I don't know if I know the right language for this, but sterilizing the animals, saying you can keep four, but they must be snipped. You tell I'm not really a vet.
I think the euphemism we use in the States is fixed, right?
That fixed, like, thank you.
Yes. Which is problematic in its own way, that we're fixing you. But and I know that that's been a big push in the States, even with like wild animals. So, for example, we have quite a few wild, feral, I guess is probably the right words, of cats on campus that don't belong to anybody, that the head of our political science department apparently feeds them. But what happens is that actually folks at the vet school will capture them and fix them and then snip actually a part of their ear off, so that when you see a cat that's missing a small amount of their ear, you're like, oh, okay, that one's already. And I do love that as an intervention just for the animals, that it's like, okay, we're going to let you live out your life, cat, but like, we're not going to let you keep, you know, overtaking the university campus with cats. And I think that's probably something we're thinking about as like an individual intervention that's going to be case by case, right? There's going to be people for whom, kind of like with substance problems, right? There are folks who are alcoholics or have alcohol use disorder and really can't have anything to drink, right? That it's just too much, that even a little bit is going to be too much for them. But there's other folks that maybe are less severe in the disorder that, okay, we can talk about what is it like to have one drink and not have more. And I think probably a similar thing for animal boarding, right? That are there folks that, you know, you can have one cat and put all your affection on that cat and you're able to survive that way. But there are other folks for whom, like, even one cat, they're going to feel the need to have more cats, right? That they're, it wouldn't be enough to just have the one.
And interestingly, I had lunch today with a colleague who stopped drinking altogether 12 months ago. He recognized that it wasn't healthy. It wasn't doing him good. But when we had lunch, he had an alcohol-free beer. And I remember thinking that was quite interesting that he's able to drink that without it making him want beer with alcohol. So yeah, there are layers and it's not a one-size-fits-all situation.
It's interesting thinking about alcohol, just that, like, I know there's a big, I think it's called the sober curious movement that they talk about here, of people, and just, I don't know what the analog would be with hoarding problems, but it's interesting to think about that there's been that push. I guess probably hoarding, the analog would be like severe minimalism, which I certainly don't think is the answer either.
No, I agree. I get anxious looking at Instagram minimalist homes. It stresses me out. So as we've talked about a little bit, from reading your work, it seems like a lack of understanding of animal hoarding in general is leading to worse outcomes because people just don't know what to do. The vet will treat it as cruelty rather than a mental health issue. And that's not to say it can't be cruelty and a mental health issue. What effect is this lack of information about the disorder having?
I like how you said that, of that it can be cruelty and a mental health issue, of that I think so often there's this impulse to infantilize people, right? That if somebody has a problem, that must mean that like everything else about them is good. And that you're like, it can be both. Also just thinking about like what, like the problems that we get from this are because we are trying to have these shortcuts, right? There were, that so often that my frustrations as a researcher is the funding people are like, well, we want something big and flashy and an intervention now. And it's like, well, we need, you know, time to do that basic research, time to get kind of make sure our foundation is right. And so that's always my worry, is that there's wanting this jump to a quick solution, that we're going to try to say, oh, if we just do this, that suddenly things will be fixed. And what we really are learning more and more about for different disorders is that individual differences in people are so important, right? That you can't just get out a treatment manual and say, here, do this, and it's going to work for everybody. But it's important to say, okay, what's going on with this person in front of me? What are the different factors that are going on that led them here? What are the other things they're dealing with, right? That, I mean, even thinking about object hoarding, a lot of my research has shown that about a third of people with object hoarding have major depressive disorder, right? And if we were ignoring that part of the person, our treatment's not going to work. And so I think what's getting lost is the kind of that need for the nuance in our conceptualization of these folks and how to best help them.
Because the people who control the funding, whether that's for research or in this country within the National Health Service, so what treatments get funded, they often want, they say there's a process that works. They then go, well, how can we shrink it and keep it effective so it's quicker and cheaper? And then they do that. And then how can we shrink it again? And the result is that currently CBT for everything.
Yes.
And it almost doesn't matter what's going on. The number of therapists trained in CBT now within the NHS is vast because somebody somewhere went, it's quick and therefore cheap, so let's do it. And that's not to say CBT can't be brilliantly helpful. I had CBT and I went into it so skeptical, thinking this is just a one size fits all, but actually I had a really positive experience. But that individual approach and the nuance and the look at, yeah, this treatment protocol might in general be effective, but how does it apply to this person's life? That can be lost a bit.
And I love that you highlighted CBT, that it's to me such a great starting point for everyone, that just drawing out our cognitive behavioral triangle. So often people are like, I'd never realized that my emotions and thoughts are connected. And that sometimes even that by itself can be so helpful for folks, just to take that moment and that breath and to say, like, what thought am I having in this moment and how am I feeling? And I think the trick is having like the therapist, the clinician who can help you say, okay, now that we've made that connection, where do we want to go with it? And really, where do you want to go? And I love that you're kind of focusing that so often the people that are funding, you know, whether it's insurance providers or whoever funds a treatment, they're like, okay, that's great that this works in 10 sessions, but maybe in 4 sessions you can get good enough.
Yeah. If we can get 80% of the result in 60% of the treatment, and it's, yeah.
And so often it just ignores that people have lives, right? That like what happens when you know, your mother gets sick and you have to skip that last session, can you get another one? And now you're dealing with the sick mother and how does that affect things? And anyway, so that's my long way of saying, I wish that I ran the world and could fix our mental health systems everywhere. But I think in the meantime, just keep trying to push for, let's do this base level work and try to find what works best and for whom.
And if somebody's listening and they are aware or they are wondering if their own situation with animals is inappropriate or out of control, if they're aware that they might not be giving their animals the care they deserve, what are some steps they can take?
It's a great question. I do think having a good relationship with your veterinarian is so important, to like be talking to them about what do they recommend, right? Are there, and the hard thing with veterinary care is there's a large range of what good veterinary care can be. That I had this thought when our sweet rabbit got old and developed arthritis, and suddenly I became the person who was giving my rabbit Advil and had opioids to help her tummy when the Advil upset. Like, and there's this kind of this range where I was like, okay, any amount of things along here is going to be helpful for her life and her quality of life. And so it was all that to say, it was so important to me to have that good relationship with the veterinarian to talk about what do I need to be doing as an animal owner to make sure that she's living the life that she needs. And talking about when are we, that we had that kind of conversation that you often have about older folks of like, are we talking about quality of life or quantity of life? But yeah, sorry for talking about my personal rabbit journey. But yes, I think if folks are thinking about for themselves, like, am I caring for my animals? Is this relationship good, I do think it goes back to those things we talked about of distress and dysfunction, right? That is either the person or the animal experiencing either of those things, right? Is the owner realizing that they're, you know, whatever's happening with their life circumstances is now such that they're are feeling this distress about having to care for their animals, that it has become too much. And that again can happen for a variety of reasons. So I think just being willing and open to have that conversation of thinking about it, is my animal situation something that's still good for me and the animals?
Many years ago, I used to watch a daytime TV program that in this country, there is an organization called the RSPCA, which is the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And the RSPCA does campaigning work, but also has like officers who work with the police if necessary to deal with animal cruelty. And this program would follow like some of their animal welfare officers just through their day. And I loved this show. I don't know why, but I did. And two things, even years later, stand out to me. One was a case where someone reported that a young woman had a dog that was never walked and never anything, just her and her dog in a room, basically. And the RSPCA officer went to visit her, and it turned out that she had learning disabilities and adored the dog, but just didn't know she was meant to walk it. So what happened was the officer gave her a collar and a lead, told her what needed to happen, and everything was great from then on because she understood now. And so she took the dog out daily and did everything she was told. And she just hadn't known. But the other thing that really stood out to me was that if they visited a home where there was, where an animal or multiple animals were not able to be cared for properly, the person with the animals always felt like they'd be judged if they gave the animals up. But the officers were really pleased and relieved if that person gave the animals up because they knew it was a difficult thing and they were really grateful that that person was putting the animal's welfare before their own wish to keep the animal. And so I suspect that's quite widespread. If you're feeling like, yeah, but if I give up the cats, people will think I'm terrible, what actually might happen is people will be really proud of you for recognizing that that is the best thing for you, for the cats, for your home.
I so agree. And I think so often folks don't realize how many organizations are out there to help find that right home. But when I was living in California, I was part of the House Rabbit Society out there. And at one point we helped, there was somebody who had developed a chronic illness and they had a rabbit that they couldn't care for. They only had one rabbit, but they just weren't able to give him a proper life. And we were able to connect that rabbit to somebody who did want it to give it a home. And so it was just that there was no shame or stigma. It was just figuring out what was best for the person and the rabbit.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any tips for finding mental health support with somebody who will have some understanding of the issue?
One of the best organizations out there for this is IOCDF, that I'm sure you're aware of, the International OCD Foundation, that they have a whole section about hoarding and ability to help find a therapist in the area. I'm always a big believer of making sure that, like, looking at kind of the things that they've treated, making sure that's something that they have a good understanding, that this wouldn't be their first time working with somebody with hoarding, for example. Just for kind of the things we talked about, to make sure that they're not going to just get out their CBT book and say, okay, this will be good enough.
Yeah. Chapter 4.
Yeah.
This is a clear Section D situation. And so, Mary, this is all so interesting. Is there anything we haven't covered that you think is important?
Probably the only other thing would be just kind of the importance of friends and family, right? That if you have a friend or family member who you're noticing isn't able to care for their animals as they used to be, that I know these are hard conversations to have, but they're good conversations too, for the reasons we just talked about, of that kind of broaching the subject of, does the person feel like they're still caring for the animal? And what would it look like, right? I mean, even just as they're a family member who can come help care for the animals, or a way to get what's best for everyone. So I think not being afraid to have those difficult conversations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Mary, if people want to find you online, how can they do so?
I guess I have a Google Scholar page, as I'm sure you found. I made a tiny website that I think it's tinyurl.com/Dozier Lab. We mostly have different highlights from our year. So I try to put up pictures of our semesterly lab brunch, so that I do it in part just so that if anybody's interested in participating in some of our studies, that they can see that we're a nice, smiley bunch of helpful folks. But yes, I'm always happy to talk to folks about these things, that they're so important. And as we talked about, so important to talk about well and respectfully, and understanding that we're all in this together.
Thank you so much. And I will link to that from the website, as always. Mary, thank you. That's been so interesting.
Thank you.
Do you want to be a dehoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to subscribe. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. So my top tip this week is from the Just One Thing podcast with Michael Mosley from BBC Radio 4. And it's a little bit of kind of general mental health advice. Have a listen.
Now, you might think that focusing on things that have gone wrong and writing about them would make things worse. But the opposite seems to be true. Research suggests that expressive writing can, in fact, reduce negative thoughts and boost your mood. And it doesn't take long. In one study, people who were asked to spend 15 minutes writing down their thoughts on 3 separate occasions not only found that doing so improved the quality of their sleep, but it also reduced how often they had negative thoughts. Of course, if you've just experienced a significant trauma or are feeling completely overwhelmed, it would be advisable to go to your GP or another health professional. But if it's low-level anxiety, the sort of thoughts that are keeping you up at night, expressive writing really could help. And it may even boost your brain power. Studies have shown that doing expressive writing before an exam can improve performance by offloading distracting, worrisome thoughts and freeing up working memory.
Now, that's the kind of thing I always kind of tell myself I'm going to do and then don't, but sounds like it could be worth actually applying myself. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast.